Today on The Grave Talks, demonic artifacts. Can historic artifacts still hold demons conjured up by ancient civilizations? What power can these entities hold over the living in the present? From demons, jinns, possession, sinister artifacts, and gruesome archaeological discoveries, Dr. Heather Lynn has been seeking out answers to these questions for quite some time. Today on The Grave Talks, we discuss the lore behind real relics believed to be the cause of hauntings and demonic possession. We also discuss the possibility of modern objects holding spirits and a message for the living. Can the archaeological record prove the existence of demons and malevolent entities?
I am an author, historian, and some call renegade archaeologist. What I do is I look into alternative sort of fringe topics, things that are outside the mainstream narrative, anything from, you know, paleo contact theory, which some people would call ancient aliens, to just mythology, folklore, symbolism, consciousness, so many different things that most people would consider a little strange. So my background is that I started actually in community college. I earned an associate's degree in archaeology and worked in archaeology and continued my studies into anthropology and earned a master's in history. My thesis actually examined the intersection of class inequality, consumer culture, propaganda, and public education, and how all of those things sort of met in early modern Europe. So nothing too, you know, outrageous or strange. Sure. Pretty, you know, common, predictable path of specialization. I went on to pursue a doctorate in education at the University of New England. In that dissertation, I raised the questions about whether or not digital technologies in museums really, you know, benefited anybody or not. I looked at the way public education in museums was handled, and basically, you know, it was something close to my heart because, you know, you go to a lot of the museums these days and you want to see artifacts. And a lot of times, I don't know if anybody's noticed this, but sometimes the museums are lighter on artifacts than they used to be. And instead, they have a lot of these gamified systems or interactive things. And, you know, while that's all fun, it replaced the traditional artifacts. And sometimes, a lot of times, surprisingly, people go looking for the artifacts and what they'll find in its place are, you know, reproductions. Mm-hmm. And to me, that was just something that, you know, I kind of have always had a passion for, fighting for the public education of history. When I was a kid, I hated history. I really hated it. It was the most boring thing to me. I wasn't very good at rote memorization, so I didn't like names and dates and memorizing those sorts of things. And I just really hated history with a passion. I was a musician, and so that's what I thought I was going to go into. And, you know, so I was like, no, history is not for me. But I actually, my divergence from mainstream anything, I think, started when I was a teenager, because I actually didn't finish high school. I left home and traveled the country just exploring and looking for answers and seeking new religious paths. And I was just kind of out there. And so I didn't follow those dreams of becoming a classical musician or anything like that. Instead, I just thought, I'm hightailing it out of here. And you know, that doesn't make for a very good future. And so once I got my act together, I went back to school and did the, you know, right thing and got myself back into a path of a more successful, you know, ordinary, you know, journey of education. And I thought, well, you know, I'll just take some things I'm interested in. And I hadn't considered history because, it was so boring.
Sure.
But I loved history. And that was the weird thing, that it didn't even occur to me how much I loved history, that, you know, I loved archaeology. When I was really little, I used to go next door to a house that had been torn down where the foundation had been left. And I used to pretend I was excavating. I would pick up all kinds of little pieces of garbage, essentially. And I thought I was on adventures. And I loved the idea of the past and documentaries. And I guess I was called, you know, an armchair historian at that point. Mm-hmm. And it just never occurred to me that I could actually do something with that until I went back to school and started taking those classes and learning about history in a new way that wasn't based in the rote memorization or the information coming from the authorities at the top down to the people. And the more I got into that, and the more I, you know, again, I was innocent and wanting to always do the right thing and go on the right path, I started seeing a lot of corruption. And when I started working in archaeology, I saw more and more corruption, and not just corruption in the sense of, funding issues or those political issues. While those are very much real and, but almost maybe expected, sadly, I started seeing things that didn't really sit well with me in a philosophical way. The idea of, some history just shouldn't be shared because people couldn't handle it, mm-hmm. or we shouldn't look into it, or there's no place for this, just disregard it. In fact, don't write it in the report, just things like that. And the more and more I got into it, the more I thought, this is kind of weird. Finally, I worked in some museums and did things, and I ended up, getting another doctorate in comparative religion and just some certificates here and there to specialize in osteoarchaeology and archaeoastronomy. And so I'm a lifelong learner. I believe in continuing education and never stopping, but I believe that it's important to educate yourself in order to pursue the things you're interested in and not the things that you think might get the best chance of funding. And so it's just basically a philosophy that I didn't agree with. And so I couldn't find that it meshed well with my values. And then I just decided, you know what? I'm not doing this. It's not worth it to me. And I'm going to pursue my interest full time in all of these strange and interesting subjects. And I'm very glad so far that's what I've been doing. And I couldn't be happier.
When it comes to being into the field or digging into the field, and you were getting some of that pushback as you were entering it, and you were hearing pushback like, oh, this shouldn't be shared with the public, they can't handle it. Well, give me an example of one of those things that stood out to you at first that you were kind of like, really? So we shouldn't talk about this?
Yeah, and that was really something that was, I was working in an urban environment. I was working in community archaeology. I did a lot with disadvantaged youth. In the summer, we did a program, the lab did a program where we were trying to help young people from an urban environment understand that there's still history underneath their feet, that it doesn't matter. A lot of movies and things will show archaeology as something that's out in the desert or these exotic places. And while that's totally true, there's more to archaeology. And that's what we were trying to, impart on the kids. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, we wanted to show them, why it's important to value that history. And so it was a really wonderful program where we're, doing these sorts of things. And so you wouldn't think that anything in that would breed any sort of controversy, at least in terms of the artifacts found. So that's probably what made it even more weird to me. So, and maybe I was inclined, honestly, my bias was already there, being that I was interested in alternative ideas. But so I we're going and in one excavation in particular, we are literally excavating within the metropolitan area, downtown, like right in the heart of downtown. Mm-hmm. And what we were finding were, we were doing some research in some of the homesteads, the early homesteads of the Rockefellers and, because Cleveland, they had a lot of homes and different things, and clearly there's an impact there. So we were just doing some things to look at how urban sprawl, suburban sprawl, how did things happen at the turn of the century and earlier, and just very basic things. So we were looking, and we were in a privy, and I found a lot of bottles of this Mrs. Winslow soothing syrup, and it's something that I took some time studying, and it was fascinating. It's this this bottle of syrup, it was one of these old time medicines that had opioids and cocaine, you'd expect.
Sure.
And it was, they would say one bottle would last the kid an entire lifetime or all of your kids because, essentially you give them a little bit and that's all it took. And you shouldn't, one bottle's enough. So just buy one bottle. Well, the thing is, we kept finding a lot of bottles, huge stashes of these bottles in individual homes. So, these, like, each home would have just tons of bottles thrown out that they were, past the age of the kid too. Like, wait a minute, what's going on? And then I took a look at this, and it wasn't very interesting to most people, but my ideas and the things that I ended up following in, my master's program was, the idea of propaganda or using marketing and advertising to, control people, even in the earliest sense before it was propaganda. And so I started looking at the advertising methods of, this particular pharmaceutical. And it Well, they hardly advertised what it did for the child. Most of the time, what was going on in the later years was it was showing these, you know, Victorian women that were decked out in very much, you know, leisurely pose on a bed. And it was just talking about how luxurious they'd feel. And it was hinting around at a lot of things. And the more I researched, the more I found that there were discussions and even, you know, hearings on this particular pharmaceutical company and how the government forever knew that this product was very dangerous, obviously, and it was not being marketed or sold with the intention of actually being used for the children as much as it was being used as a drug for the moms. And they were advertising this glamorous lifestyle of the mothers, you know, who would just, they'd be high on this all day, and that's why there were so many bottles. And it was coincidental because, you know, in the area, it was actually close to one of the very first, if not the very first, woman's only opioid clinics. And so, and I'm looking at this and I'm like, wow, this is nuts. You know, it's just not that big a deal. Not, I wouldn't say controversial much. And, it was like, oh yeah, well, you know, how about not? Like, wait a minute, what? I have this great research project, this paper, look at this. This is amazing. I had some, you know, bottle specialists. I had people lined up and it was like, yeah, we don't think we should put that out. Like, wait, what are you talking about? Opinions here? That really struck me as odd. Like, why? Tell me why. Why shouldn't we put this out there? Like, it's research. It should just be objective. This does not compute. And it's, you know, it was just left at that until one evening, you know, we were at a restaurant, had a few drinks going and, you know, talking about fundraising for the lab. And then it was told to me, well, you know, the people who pay, the people who were trying to appeal for the funds, the quote stakeholders, that was always a term thrown around with stakeholders. They want a certain thing found and a certain thing not. And that's really what we need to focus on. And it was just like the honesty started flowing. And, it, you know, little things like that just started getting me to think, well, this is a silly little. So this was at a community college. I was like, it was a huge community college, but I was like, this is at a community college in an urban environment. This isn't groundbreaking. Well, no pun intended. This isn't groundbreaking stuff. And yet we're beholden to these mysterious stakeholders for what? I don't even know the end game here. And it was so compartmentalized. And all I could think was, if it's this bad here, then what's going on elsewhere? Mm-hmm. And then that's, you know, I had that thought. And, you know, some years later, that's when, you know, I started researching a little more of the, I guess, the idea of stakeholders and the corruption in that side of things or on that side of things. And that's what led me to put out my report, The Sumerian Controversy. And that's when I started, you know, looking into who's funding major excavations in the Middle East. Because, again, I thought if this is happening in, a small urban center, now, what over these small issues, these are not big issues, and what other meddling is going on with the quote stakeholders? What is the state of this quote science? You know, what is happening here? And so I really got more and more interested in looking at the, you know, the money end of it and trying to find what's really going on here. And that's when I started to find that, you know, there's excavations happening in the Middle East that are funded by what you'd think would be universities. And then you find out, well, who's funding the grants and the foundation and the lab, and who's really funding that aspect of the university? And then you find that it's big oil companies, or maybe possibly worse, depending on your, you know, how you look at things, private collectors of antiquities. So that right there is like, wait a minute. So you're telling me if you know, in this particular one that I wrote about with a Thyssen from the Thyssen family dynasty, he is considered having the largest collection of antiquities, except for the queen. They don't know if he or the queen of England actually, who has the most antiquities. So they just don't know for sure, but he's right up there. So if we're talking major collector, and he's the one who has laundered money through different foundations and going through to sprinkle it down into the university system you know, it's this way of taking money from the top and sprinkling it down so that people that are on the ground, like some of the archaeologists, they don't really know who's funding this. They just think, well, I'm working for the university. It's the university. There's grants, sure, but, you know, there's so much compartmentalization and corruption going on in that, that to me, that's just an absolute conflict of interest to think that, okay, we have this hugely powerful billionaire figure who collects antiquities for himself so that he can have them in his living room, literally. And he even stated in an interview, this Thyssen in particular, he stated in an interview that, wow, I couldn't believe that you could just buy these things. Like, he's so just out of touch, you know? And so this is a person that is out there, you know, doing this. And so I'm thinking, well, now is he not interested in finding any antiquities for himself? Or if they find something grand, I mean, they actually, when they do the reports, at least in this particular excavation in, this was in Iraq, when they were doing the work, they would make the reports that they would give from the sites. And before presenting them to the public at all, they actually would present them in a board meeting at the oil company to the stakeholders, such as the big, you know, banking families, the Thyssens, all these different stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And that's who they had to present that information to. So I'm sorry, but I don't feel that that is enough oversight and that you're that far away and what's going on. And so if you take just an average museum, you know, in which they also engage in a lot of, you know, corruption and, you know, buying looted artifacts and doing these things. And I mean, it's just a whole world of, you know, unsavory characters and things that are, you know, it got me. And and so that's something that I had just followed. And I think it just started from that idea when I was younger that, wow, even the small time archaeology has this level of corruption. Yeah. What's going on elsewhere? And then when I find out elsewhere, it's even worse or what I expected or feared. Well, then it's like, I can't be part of this machine. I have to, I guess, in a way, work against it. Mm-hmm. You know, and that, I don't mean to take an adversarial angle to that degree, but I just feel that the public needs to know.
Sure. I remember when I was a child reading, I couldn't tell you what book it was, but it was something about what some museums hold in their back rooms and their storage areas. And it was a book about the paranormal, and it was written for children, but I found it so interesting. And it was one of those early ones that really got me into the some of the ideas of, wow, the cursed objects or cursed artifacts and things of that nature. I believe it referenced several Smithsonian items. I know the Hope Diamond was in there, but there was a statue. Again, we're referencing something that I read when I was like 8. So I'm trying to remember the details from 30 years ago. But it was one of those things where it's like, wow, is this real? Does this really exist? And purportedly, you know, it was. And that was one of the things that I found interesting when I started to look at your book, Evil Archaeology. Take us into that world a bit, and let's talk about some of the historical artifacts that are out there that may be on display publicly, but even more interestingly, maybe in the back rooms, in the storage areas, in the archives that don't get out to the public, that are not seen on a regular basis in museums all over the world.
Well, something that I find incredibly interesting is the Sumerian culture. And the Sumerians, 4,000 years ago, were just on the cutting edge of some of the most inventions we use today, just maths and sciences and, you know, agricultural techniques. I mean, a very amazing culture. It's the culture that a lot of, you know, people will speculate could be ancient alien or whatnot. So there's a lot of stuff out there. People are interested in looking at this, the Sumerians. Back in the day, it used to be everyone was about Egypt, and there was like this term, Egyptomania. Well, now we are, I think, coming into Sumermania, where people are just really interested in this culture. And I think part of that has to do with the work of Zechariah Sitchin and others who published in the 70s or 80s or, you know, around that era. And, you know, and not a lot has come out since that was quite as groundbreaking. Most of the work that comes out after that seems to be more just commentary on Sitchin or the particular artifacts that are referenced in some of that alternative literature. So, you know, I started looking more into this. What you have is this schism between the people who want to look at the Sumerian cuneiform tablets and artifacts as, you know, these sort of depictions of aliens and, you know, whatever they may find in the Sitchin work. And if they reject that, then they only do so seemingly because they're trying to debunk it, and they rely on these, you know, other names in the field that are out there saying, no, it means this. And they're usually Bible oriented. So they're oftentimes their lens that they're seeing this through is something religious. And so it's really hard. Then they're both separated, and then there's nothing in between. And what it does is it would lead people to believe that nothing is being done in that realm. And that's just not true. The amount of artifacts and cuneiform tablets that are out there and available are just immense. The problem is there aren't that many people who are in the field looking into, you know, translating them, because there's just simply not that many people employed in that area. But that doesn't mean that they're not. And so I feel like that area of inquiry into the past has been in a sense of suspended animation to some degree since maybe the 70s or the 80s. And what I've done in, you know, recent years out of curiosity, because I started looking at, you know, these archaeological sites, and people would then ask me, well, what do you think is there? What could they be hiding? And I was like, well, I don't know, you know. And so I started looking into it more, and I thought, well, you know, this is fascinating. And it's led me down that path to look more into the Sumerian culture. In doing so, I found that there are cuneiform tablets all over these museums, just hidden in a way from public viewing, and not necessarily, in my opinion, because they're being kept from the public, but just because they are storing them. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe some of them are being kept, but maybe they're not. I really have no way of saying, you know, about people's motivations, but there are many. I mean, there's just thousands. And so, you know, what's fascinating too, we were talking about, you know, Iraq a little bit. The Iraq National Museum, it had been looted at one point. And that was something that, you know, it was actually in 2003, the museum closed and was looted. And, you know, it was a really devastating thing. But some of the artifacts that were stolen were cuneiform tablets. And they stole thousands of these tablets. And now, sometimes when people see these tablets online, they look very big. But that's because a lot of times there's not anything there for scale. So, and tablets, you think of the movie, you know, with Moses or something holding a big tablets up. And sure. But in this context, the tablets are quite small. They're handheld. So if somebody can, you know, in this case, they looted the museum and took 5,144 tablets. That sounds like impossible, but you got to consider they're very small, and they could take them out in bags. And so that's just one bit of them. And what you're looking at then is, you know, thousands of tablets in these museums or looted or on the black market or everywhere, because the Sumerians were record keepers of just amazing, amazing degree. They wrote everything down. They were very administrative. And so there's tons of records, and it's just everywhere. So there's a lot of things left to look at. And so what I've done is start to dig, you know, into that a little bit. And in that research, I started to find some very interesting things. And, you know, some of which was on exorcisms. And, you know, it was interesting. There's about 1,000 cuneiform tablets held by the British Museum, and 660 of them specifically reference exorcism. And I thought, oh, that's really, that's mm-hmm. really fascinating, you know. And so because I've had this, you know, interest in Sumerian artifacts and belief systems and that sort of thing, I had, and this is a part of the inspiration for the book, oddly enough, the movie The Exorcist was on one day, and I hadn't seen it in years. And the beginning scene from the movie and the book, it's actually set in Iraq at an archaeological excavation. Mm-hmm. At the site, there's a priest archaeologist who feels this wind blowing that foreshadows the arrival of the demon of the southwestern wind named Pazuzu. And that demon was the demon implicated in the possession of the main character in that film. And that, I was like, wait, that is an actual demon. I hadn't really noticed that example before. And so I thought that was an interesting attention to detail, linking a modern case of possession to something very ancient and Mesopotamian in that sense. And it wasn't long after seeing the movie that I actually read a news story about a man in North Carolina who was caught murdering, cannibalizing, burying his neighbors in his backyard, or, well, his mother's backyard. He lived with his mother, go figure. And it was wild. And then I, you know, but it didn't sound completely unusual, sadly, because there are a lot of creeps out there. But then I heard his name, and his name was Pazuzu. And I thought, wait, what? Pazuzu? I just heard that was really weird. And he actually changed his name legally to Pazuzu because he believed that he was following some sort of Sumerian religion that involved a monthly blood sacrifice to Pazuzu. And I mean, he was really clearly whacked out. And So it started making me think, though, you know, yes, he obviously was to blame for this, you know, 100%. But I thought about that idea of being inspired. He was inspired by this Pazuzu. And so that word inspired in Latin, you know, comes from the Latin inspirare, meaning to breathe or blow into. And so the word inspired originally in that context described when specifically a supernatural being imparted an idea to somebody. Mm-hmm. And so if somebody then did something in the spirit of, you know, that was something to consider in a supernatural level. And while it was, you know, maybe just semantic differences or splitting hairs, to me, that was enough to cause a moment of pause. And I started thinking, well, you know, how far back do these ideas of demons go? I mean, it's amazing that a Mesopotamian, you know, Sumerian style demon can inspire someone to this day to do these terrible things. And then that's what I started looking into is, you know, the history of demons and the possessions and, you know, how the archaeological record may support or, you know, deny, I guess, some of the claims that are made by people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's when I found some of these tablets. And it's quite fascinating because the origin of the exorcisms are, you know, based in medical practice. So of these 1,000 cuneiform tablets, well, 1,000 of them were medical texts that were used to train physicians in ancient Sumer. And so they lay out very specifically ways to perform exorcisms and, you know, how and why and all of this. And these are not ones that are really out there for people that, you know, because, well, for one thing, if you look at them, they have this cuneiform writing on them. And, you know, there's so many that it takes research to put it out there. And so, you know, in one method described on the tablet, it's actually kind of humorous. It's a, you'd model a clay figure of a demon and put them in a pit, and you'd fight them kind of like a game of Rock'em Sock'em Robots in a way, or like, you know, and so something not quite what we think of as an exorcism. And so there's all these weird things they do, but, you know, there were some things that looked very similar to the exorcisms that we think about today, like in a pop cultural sense, the idea of having to demand to know the name of the demon. And the text pretty much lays that out very specifically, that demon, what is your name? That notion, you know, comes from the idea that you essentially, if you're looking at this possessed person as maybe a patient, you need to know what it is they're suffering from in order to treat it. And so it's like in a way, a primitive or maybe early diagnostic tool to say, demon, what is your name? And once you found out the name of the demon, you know how to successfully treat that. And so that tradition and some of the things that, you know, were practiced then, you can see little elements of it even in the Catholic rituals of exorcism and in some ways, you know, other religions as well and what they do. So I found that continuity fascinating.
It's very interesting and bizarre to think about some of these, the names, the demonic names, and some of the very specific things to the texts showing up in modern culture or in modern society, where they wouldn't have, you know, accidentally come across some of this information, and then through whatever mental disorder are, you know, using that information for whatever is going on in their lives. It almost points more to an idea that maybe there is something attached to some of these objects or something of that nature that then is getting out, the Sumerian demons, if you will, into society. It almost sounds very Ghostbusters-ish when we're talking about Sumerian. I'm picturing Egon Spengler talking about, you know, the Sumerian demons in Vigo or something. But it very much, you know, it's kind of along those lines. Have you found, I mean, I know you mentioned that case, but when it comes to things like this and some of the archaeological evidence and artifacts that are out there, what is out out there that supposedly has curses to it, or that people have been affected by in an unexplained way.
Oh, there's just so many, and so many that I couldn't even include them all in the book. And sure. So I did. I took a little sampling of some that, some things like talisman or objects that people would use to protect them. But what we find a lot is this idea of the everyday curse, something that, you know, more often than not, when you look for these cursed objects, they are items like home furnishings or jewelry or sometimes even toys like spooky dolls, you know, those sorts of things. And, it's not really surprising, I suppose, because these are things that people encounter on a regular basis and hold some meaning. But I look into that a little bit, and there's so many. One of my favorite, and this is, I don't know why, but I love this one a lot. It's the case of the crying boy. In the 1950s, there was prints of a painting that were mass produced of this boy that was very somber looking and crying. And for some reason, people loved it. It had a huge commercial success, and people were just hanging this up everywhere, which is, I think, weird in and of itself. But hey, you know, different times. And so, you know, I actually remember having a very similar picture. I have a memory of a picture like that hanging in the attic of my grandmother's house, which always scared me. I thought, why is this creepy kid? Why does she have this picture? It was so weird. But it was a very, very popular painting that from the 50s on up until even the 90s, people were just loving these pictures of these crying boys. And so, you know, they remained popular. But then in the 80s, a house burned down and the whole thing had been left in a pile of ashes, but the crying boy painting was there, and it was completely unharmed. And so most people thought, oh, that's creepy, you know, until other people started reporting the same thing happened. And then it just became a huge phenomenon where, you know, firefighters started claiming that, yes, this is true. And then that's when people started taking notice, when the firefighters would go and say, yes, at the scene, we found everything gone except for the painting. And so for years, the story just started becoming an urban legend, and it was really freaky, and it made the painting even more popular. And then the BBC actually decided that they were going to break the story and uncover what was really going on. And they found that the paintings were surviving, and this was an actual phenomenon. But they also found out that they had been covered with a fire retardant varnish, which is why they stayed in that way. And so I always loved that story because it captured the imagination of people for decades. Mm-hmm. And people forever started thinking, well, this is not true, or this is true. And, you know, the discussion around that just was, I just think, interesting. And then to find out, well, all along it was just because it was fire retardant, you know, I thought that was quite funny.
Sure.
And so, you know, you find a lot of stories like that with household objects. So pictures and, you know, and it's a lot of times what I found, at least in my research, is that the ones that are related to these household objects, whether it be, you know, the case of a possessed bunk bed, which I include in the book. There's many dolls that people find or claim are haunted. And, you know, people love those stories, especially with the Annabelle and, you know, some of these movies and things. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times what I found is that these are just, you know, unprovable or sometimes not the case. They're not necessarily true. And so, but it doesn't mean that they're all not true. It's just if you're looking for archaeological evidence, if you're looking for something to measure and quantify, it's just not there. And most of the time you find that there's ways to say, well, you know, it was covered with a fire retardant varnish. And so,
sure. You
know, it seems that the, a physical object, you know, it's very hard to determine if something like that can contain evil and any kind of like malevolent force. And so what I did for the book is I interviewed a couple of people that maybe this was more their bailiwick than mine. So definitely a paranormal researcher. I contacted him, Mike Ricksecker. And he is what you'd think of as a paranormal researcher. He has the tools and the capability and the experience and a very objective way at looking at things, which I respected. And, I think he's really legit in what he's doing. He's trying to find evidence. And so I asked him about these things, like, can you really detect energy or malevolent forces. And, you know, I compared his scientific approach to a modern day exorcist named Bill Bean, who, you know, has a different way of looking at it. He comes from a religious background. And, and I asked him the same things. Like, well, what do you think? Can these things, you know, carry these negative, I don't know whether they be energies or actual beings. Is this possible? And, you know, the answers were different in both ways, which I guess you'd expect. But so for me, you know, the idea that an object can contain evil or some sort of malevolent force, it really has to be something we can measure with some sort of element of proof. And so the only thing that I found, well, for one thing, you know, the idea of demons in general, there's really no evidence for the existence of, you know, a demon body. You know, it's sort of like a Bigfoot thing. Well, where's the body? Mm-hmm. Well, yes, sometimes you could think of a demon as being etheric and it's just like a spirit. But if we're looking at stuff in a material sense, you know, then we have to think, well, where are any bodies of these creatures? And, you know, so there is an interesting case in Russia of a demon skull being found. They're calling it a demon skull. And this is one that, you know, it's not really debunked, and it's hard to debunk, and a lot of people don't know what it is. And until people can get there, it's really out of the way. There's a man who owns a cabin up in the wilderness, essentially, and he has, you know, had like a museum of all these different Nazi artifacts that have been found in the area, and including this weird skull that people have called the alien skull or a demon skull. And you know, it's a fascinating one. So I wouldn't want to imply that it's definitely a skull of a demon, but it is something that is new and interesting, and another source of speculation that I think more people would probably be interested in. There's really great pictures online. I wasn't able to include the pictures in the book because they are not mine. Mm-hmm. But if you go online and just sort of look for the things that I have in the book, you'll see huge, you know, high resolution pictures of this skull that looks like a demon skull. And it has been determined that it's, you know, a being, a physical being, but they don't really know of what, you know, what is this? And so, I mean, most people's guesses are that it's an animal that over time, you know, its skull got shaped by, you know, water or some sort of, you know, sediment or something. And so there's plenty of explanations, but, you know, just for curiosity's sake, it is a weird and interesting skull. And the story about how it was found and how close it was found to a Nazi archaeological excavation is also a little weird. And so I try to put a lot of strange, unusual, you know, stories into the book, as well as, you know, some of the more common ones like the mummy's curse.
That wraps up part one of our interview with Dr. Heather Lynn about demonic artifacts. In part two of our interview, we'll continue the conversation and ask the question, are there any cases where a Sumerian demon came back to torment the living? Are there any cases where an artifact was proven to be haunted? What's the story behind the case of the haunted bunk bed? What is the story behind a demon skull that was found in Russia? Is the case of the mummy's curse a real thing, or is there any evidence for it? And is there a way for science and demonology to work together? All of that and more in part two of our interview with Dr. Heather Lynn. Until next time for the Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.